Hey, everybody. Just wanted to give a quick heads up that our coverage of It turned out to be pretty lengthy, so we're going to split it into two parts. So stay tuned for the first part, and next week we'll pick back up with part two. Bye.
So, have any good chucks lately?
Oh, that's such a fantastic segue. And yes, I have. I have had many good chucks this week.
Good.
Beep, beep, Clark. Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
I'm Karina.
I'm Clark.
And welcome to It's Always Spooky.
It's Always Spooky.
I am so fucking stoked.
It's finally here.
It's finally here.
I only had to wait close to 4 or 5 months. I feel like I brought up it during one of the first episodes that we did.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially when we were doing The Shining, though.
Yeah. Well, because I remember it was brought up because, yeah, it was in like one of the first episodes because we were talking about like the movies that made us love the movies and then like the books that we really loved that got us into the genre for reading and everything.
Yep.
And I know that you had mentioned it was your favorite.
It was the pinnacle for me in terms of favorite novels. So we decided to do the same thing that we did with The Shining, where we're going to focus mainly on the movies. In this case, to save on time, we're going to do the 2017 and the 2019, the newer adaptations by the, I think it's by the Muschietti siblings, or who directed it. And then we'll salt and pepper in kind of our favorite highlights from the book now that you've finished the novel and I've recently reread it.
Yeah.
When did you finish it? Like, how long did it take you?
Once I actually like buckled down and started reading, it took probably like 2 weeks, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Which that was me taking my time with it too, because I really wanted to digest everything and really appreciate everything that went into that, because it's interesting for me to say this or for me to hear myself say this, because I don't often come across a book that is 1,000+ pages where I fully believe that every single page needed to be there.
Yes.
And every single part of this book needed to be there. So I sat there and just felt it.
Yeah,
really
took your time and like digested it fully.
Yeah,
I think that is what's really necessary for this book. I know for me, I mean, I've probably been listening to it. I had to rent it twice through Libby. So like I've had it for at least, they let me have it for 21 days. So it's taken me like at least 2 months.
Yeah,
probably maybe more than that to actually finish it.
Even the audiobook is fucking 47 hours.
Yes.
So
I remember when I got to the halfway point and I was just like, holy shit, I finally got past the 50% mark.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I still have 15 more hours or something like that to go.
Yeah.
It's absolutely incredible.
I approached reading and listening to this one in the same way that I approached The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading out of the physical book before I would go to bed at night. I would pick up where I left off listening to it to go to sleep. And then I would wake up in the morning, listen to it on my way to work.
Sure.
And then go back to where I started listening to it with the ebook while I was at work and
read it.
Yeah, read it again.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
I'm pretty sure I read it twice.
Yeah.
In totality.
That's fantastic.
And I'm so fucking stoked that I did. It was so good.
And now we get to talk about it. Yeah. That'd be sick. Okay, well, to kind of get like our main metadata points out of the way, I kind of figured that for these two movies, we'd kind of like do everything together. So all the metadata together, all the themes together, all the fave and scary scenes, all the trivia, that kind of stuff. So
yeah, that sounds good.
I wrote these kind of in this sequence here. So for chapter one, so honestly, this is like one of my favorite title cards I've ever seen. So it's after Georgie's death. You're coming through the standpipe in the Barrens and you hear all like the children laughing. They're like singing some, you know, ditty, and it's like kind of spinning and rotating. And as you're coming out, it just has it just in that really creepy, like drippy font.
Yeah.
It's fucking awesome. And then the 2019 one, also kind of fun because it kind of plays the same theme where it's after the cold open, which we will talk about. And it's just it. Chapter two, but it's in like a funhouse lights for the carnival that's towards the end. The tagline for 2017's It was You'll Float Too, and then 2019's It Chapter Two was You'll Float Again, which lame.
Yeah.
Out of all the things you could have, but anyways, And then finally, I put metadata down here. So for 2017, their budget was $35 million. Opening weekend was September 10th of 2017. They made $123.5 million. And then their gross worldwide was $704 million.
Damn.
For 2019, their budget was twice that. It was almost $80 million, so $79 million.
Wow.
Opening weekend, September 8th of 2019, made $91 million. And gross worldwide was $473 million.
Wow.
So it made more money.
Yeah.
Than Chapter One did. But the budget was significantly greater. And I think it really hurt the second movie.
Yeah.
With how much money they threw at it.
I think it did too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll talk about all of that.
We'll definitely get into that because I think a few factors were at play there, like paying adult actors so they were going to be paid more.
Sure.
Also, there was so much CGI in the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Like constant.
Constantly. Yeah. Because there was a lot of CGI in the first one too, but I felt like they utilized it a little bit better.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I can go through the cast list really quick. It's kind of a big cast list. So, I kind of stuck to like the core seven.
Yeah.
And then Henry. I wrote this cool, like, I think it was like a cast list where I did their child actors, and then I can't see because I have my glasses on. Let me
see. You mean like this?
Yes, yes. But the way you did it, you did their character names and then the actors that played them. I put their character names in the middle.
Ooh.
And did like their actor and like on either side to kind of.
Oh, I love
it.
That.
So, got Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise.
Yes.
Got Jaden Martell as Bill, also played by James McAvoy as an adult. We got Finn Wolfhard playing Richie, also played by Bill Hader as an adult. Sophia Lillis plays Beverly, who's also played by Jessica Chastain as an adult. Jeremy Ray Taylor plays Ben Hanscom, who's played by Jay Ryan as an adult. Jack Dylan Grazer plays Eddie, who's played by Jay Maransone as an adult. We got Chosen Jacobs, who plays Mike as an adult, is played by Isaiah Mustafa. Wyatt Olef plays Stanley, who as an adult is played by Andy Bean. And then I finally just put Henry. So Nicholas Hamilton plays Henry Bowers, who as an adult is played by Teach Grant.
All right. I forgot to write down Henry, so I'm glad you did.
Yeah, I thought about putting down Belch and Victor and Patrick, but like it's already a giant cast list.
Yeah.
And we are really like, I had written in my notes for the book that the movies kind of only span maybe 200 or 300 years.
Yeah.
And the book spans like literal eons of time, right?
Yeah.
It gets really crazy. And so I felt like the main portion of this story centers on the Losers Club, which is these seven children.
Yeah.
And then everybody else is just kind of like an extension. Like I can easily think of probably a dozen, if not more, characters that are consistent secondary characters.
Yeah.
Very, very integral to the story. But it just didn't seem relevant to actually put them in this huge cast list here.
Yeah. And especially when there is already such a solid, like, what other stories do we have that there are seven main characters?
No shit.
And then on top of that, a lot of the secondary and tertiary characters are very prevalent in the book,
mm-hmm.
but they are really only just grazed in the
movie. In the movie.
Even mm-hmm. even Henry's part is much lesser in the movie than
in
or
the
in the
book.
Movies than it is in the book.
Yes, I can agree with you on that. I'm glad that like I've watched the miniseries before and I felt like the second time around, like the Mushia, they did a really good job of picking the right sections of the book to tell.
Yeah.
Because this is truly one of those books that like I don't think it would be possible to really tell it perfectly without it being not just a miniseries, but like a fucking show.
Yeah.
Like something that went on for several seasons. And I also just felt like in probably both iterations, there wasn't a lot of good planning when it came to actually telling the story. Like in the book, they did this really interesting thing where they were constantly telling you the story through both the children and the adult's perspective.
Yeah.
Almost seamlessly. Like you'd start out with the child's perspective and it would bleed straight into the adult's perspective. And so you didn't have like a, this is the child's version and then this is the adult version coming back to Derry because they were done simultaneously.
Yeah.
And I felt like in the TV show and in the movies, they did it the opposite way. They're like, this is the story that we tell of the kids and the pact they made. And then we'll tell the story after the fact of like when they have to come back to the town to defeat the evil the second time.
Yeah. Yeah. With some really poorly planned, oddly placed flashbacks that actually go in the middle of the timeline for the first movie, but we're going to do it in the middle of the second movie.
Yeah.
Made sense.
That was just it. Like, I don't know. And maybe it was just because we've watched a couple of movies for the podcast recently that do a lot less handholding and a lot less exposition.
Yeah.
And it made the exposition in this movie like so much more stark to me where I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Anyways, after getting into all of the cast, I didn't actually write down themes, but I'm sure we could like spitball them together.
Oh, I got you.
Oh, yeah.
I got you. So for themes, I wrote, it's a coming of age story, technically, childhood trauma, overcoming evil, the classic good versus evil story.
Absolutely.
The malevolence of small town culture, which is much more prevalent in the book than it is, I feel like, in either of the movies.
Sure. There's a lot of hints to it in the movies, but obviously the book fleshes it out a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah, because in the book, you truly do get, you get Derry as a character.
Yeah.
More so than you do in the movies.
Absolutely.
And then the very last one is just the power of friendship.
Yep. Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because like that's always like my biggest one, where I'm like, when people ask me what it's about, I'm like, it's about the power of friendship. Like, it's about how do you, like, banding together when you're just a bunch of like losers, you're just a bunch of outcasts. It's like the ability to like overcome great obstacles by working together. And like, that's the only way that you do actually succeed is by working together.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that is the integral part of being able to overcome the big bad,
the big evil
in this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is.
Yeah. It's not only like your friendship, but also like your belief.
Yeah.
Like, what you believe in has power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm really excited, especially to get into us talking about like the ritual of Chud and that sort of thing, especially contrasting the book and the movies, because the ritual is so different.
Yes. It's so, so different. Well, shall we get into our favorites?
Ooh, I did.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention?
I wrote down a brief synopsis.
Oh, shit.
We may or may not keep it. We'll see.
Oh, okay.
But
well, you're going to do it for like both the first and the second.
Yeah, it's kind of just like an overarching, here's a general idea of what's going on.
Got it.
Children in the town of Derry, Maine seem to disappear at an alarming rate. When the little brother of one, Bill Dembra, becomes one of the missing, Bill and his gang of self-proclaimed losers make a pact to destroy whatever evil terrorizes their community.
Yeah. See, I like that.
Yeah.
Because that's very condensed, too, because this is one of those where, like, if somebody were to ask me about it, it's hard to describe it without going on a fucking tangent. Right? Isn't that just about a killer clown that eats children? And you're just like, no, that's not even remotely what it's about.
The way that my head could turn into a red balloon and float away every time somebody says that.
Right? And, like, I'm even thinking, like, I've got the book right here. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, the little description back here is like two paragraphs. To the children, the town was their whole world. To the adults, knowing better, Derry, Maine was just their hometown. Familiar, well-ordered, a good place to live. It was the children who saw and felt what made Derry so horribly different. In the storm drains, in the sewers, it lurked, taking on the shape of every nightmare, each person's deepest dread. Sometimes it reached up, seizing, tearing, killing. The adults, knowing better, knew nothing. Time passed, and the children grew up and moved away. The horror of it was deep buried, wrapped in forgetfulness, until the grown-up children were called back once more to confront it as it stirred and coiled in the sullen depths of their memories, reaching up again to make their past nightmares a terrible present reality. Frightening, epic, and brilliant, Stephen King's It is one of the greatest works of a true storytelling master. I also have to point this out. In these two paragraphs here, it is mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. They're all capitalized.
Yeah.
Every single one. Because it's very, very important to know that it is the entity, like the big bad. And they the children call it it because to them, they all see it as something very different.
Yeah.
And I think it's the only way that they can, as children, be able to talk about it, like in, because they can't call it like the mummy or the werewolf or the leper, like, because it's different for everyone. So it, I think it's Bill that says like it lives in the sewers. It took Georgie.
It's also speaking to both the experience of reading the book and talking about it with people.
Yeah.
Saying it, everybody's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, I'm literally talking about it.
It.
There,
it's
it.
It.
It is the book It and the movies It.
It. Yeah. It. It.
Yeah.
It. And they're like, the Deadlights.
What?
The, yeah. The Eater of Worlds.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah. Bob Gray, Pennywise, Bob Gray, It.
Yeah, whatever you want to call him. Yeah. And I like how, like, he only was using the guise of Pennywise for probably like the shortest amount of time. Because in the Ritual of Chewed, Mike saw Pennywise, the Deadlights, come to Earth in a meteor, crash it down in, like, from outer space. And then it probably didn't have food for a long time, probably laid dormant for a long time, probably through an ice age or something like that, and then woke up as settlers were starting to come into the town.
Yeah.
Because that's when it ate all like 300, 200 to 300 people.
Yeah. Yeah. Because in the lore of Derry that Ben ends up reading through in the library, they talk about how everybody disappeared.
All the original settlers of Derry.
Yeah. All of the original people disappeared. And then it was like resettled.
Yeah. Yeah. After that. And after that point, like, I'm sure the Deadlights ate everybody in that town for that first time because it was so hungry. I mean, from wherever it came from, the macroverse, right? And then landed here. And then after that point, it kind of, I don't know if it decided this, but a predator doesn't want to move locations. So it's not going to completely decimate its population. It's going to allow it to have like just enough so that it can keep repopulating and having more food available.
Yeah. It. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's so good. I wish that you got, which of course, as you had said, without making this into a full show with like multiple seasons, there would not be a way to give all of the backstory that you get in the book. But the story of Derry is really cool.
It was really cool.
So fun to learn about it, especially knowing that the town of Derry is actually modeled after the city of Bangor, Maine.
Uh-huh.
But the city of Bangor, Maine still exists in this world that Stephen King has created.
Yeah.
Derry is just another town.
It's just another small town that's similar.
But even the Paul Bunyan statue is an actual statue in Bangor, Maine.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, he just like brought it into Derry instead.
Yeah, that makes total sense, right? Yeah. You write what you know, and like that's what he knew.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
And he, for part of the year, still lives there. And the Stephen and Tabitha King Foundation house that has the really cool bats on the fence and all that kind of stuff is in Bangor, Maine.
Oh, that's so cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I kind of love that. Yeah, and I will tell you, like, the second movie compared to the first movie, it's not my favorite, but I did appreciate the way that like they did the Ritual of Chewed.
Yeah.
They showed the way that Mike showed Bill by drugging him and him seeing the Shakopee people trying to get the Deadlights into the relic.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of cool because they did a couple of like these little iterations of what the Shakopee people imagined it to look like, right?
Yeah.
Because they were saying that like there wasn't a way for human brains or eyes to be able to comprehend what the Deadlights looked like, and so it was just whatever was closest.
Yeah.
Whatever was the closest thing you could possibly comprehend. And for most adaptations it was like this spider-like creature.
Yeah.
And I like in the book, like when they're chasing after the Deadlights, as it starts to get weaker, it doesn't ever look like a clown anymore.
No.
It looks like a bunch of different things, but it always looks like the Deadlights are powering it somehow.
Yeah. So that's one of my biggest gripes. And I'll actually come back to the gripe. But going backward a little bit, I don't remember in the book them ever talking about a native tribe.
The Shakopee people are in part 4 or 5.
Are they really? I don't remember
it
like
at all. It's a very, very small portion because, like, that's how I'm pretty sure that's how Mike learns about the Ritual of Chud.
I thought the Ritual of Chud was a Himalayan thing.
Oh, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just blading the movie and the book.
I can't remember because
I think you're right though, because I want to say that like Bill just read about the ritual. They didn't actually, and that's when they did the smoke hole ceremony when they were kids.
Yeah, because Bill found out that it was a glamour.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh man, I really wanted to talk about that scene, and I'm glad that you brought that up. We should talk about that.
Yeah.
So, I really focused on the movies, but.
And if I get too booky, let's like pull it back.
I know, right?
That's what I'm saying. I know that happened with The Shining, but the big gripe that I have is that I understand why people think that this is a movie about a killer clown.
Yes.
Because these two movies really lean into it as a clown.
And the miniseries.
And the miniseries leans into it as a clown.
Well, it certainly got plenty of that.
And what bothers me so much about that, besides the fact that this story has very little to do with a clown, is that if they would have just used the imagery in the book where they talk about how, oh, this creature had orange pom-poms that were on it, or this creature had these weird orange lights and like that sort of stuff. If they were to have just gone with that imagery, the concept of that being it would have carried.
I think so.
Yeah.
I really think it would have. And I wonder if like that was just too much of hoping that your audience would do the homework. But I agree that I feel like they lean too much on the clown.
Yeah.
And there were plenty of opportunities where you could have shown the clown for 50% of it. But then as time went on, as the illusion started to die down, and even as like the deadlights became weaker, you started to lose those like facades, because I don't think that the deadlights would use them if it was truly terrified. It would just be trying to look for any other avenue possible. And so I would like better for it to, instead of being like very obvious clown, being homages. The silver suit, the orange pom buttons, right? The like the orange hair, like those types of things.
Yeah.
I did like Pennywise's costume in the newer movies, because it is very tried and true of what he was supposed to look like in the books.
Absolutely.
But I absolutely agree with you where it's like he's Pennywise the clown is not supposed to be the main creature. The main facade of the creature, because the creature doesn't even look like a clown.
No.
It's just manifesting all of these different things because it wants to create terror before it eats.
Yeah, because I remember, and we didn't get this in the movie, but in the book there's a big bird section. And I remember when they're talking about the bird, they're talking about how it opens its mouth and it has these orange pom-poms in its mouth. And I'm like, if you could have just put orange fucking pom-poms after you show the orange fucking pom-poms on Pennywise, people would have got it.
It would have registered, or even just like the leper.
Yeah.
The leper could have had pom-poms.
Yep.
Right? Just like little tiny things like that. But
what do you want me to do about it?
A shout out to the different forms that it takes in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Nick's favorite was the cunty flute player.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he really liked her.
She had a name, but I don't remember what it was. Like, it was something the flute player, but yeah.
She was great.
Yeah, oh, God. Yeah, I'm trying to think of my favorite. I mean, I'll be honest. Like, in the first movie, I love fucking Pennywise. Like, I loved that opening scene with Georgie. And in the second movie, I love that moment with Victoria under the bleachers. Like, there are moments where, like, that fucking clown sells it real good.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, let's get into our favorite scenes.
Yeah, let's do it.
I was figured we'll just do like chapter one and then we'll do chapter two.
That works for me.
Okay. So for, actually I want to know, what's your favorite scene?
Oh, okay.
I want to know your favorite scene from chapter one.
Or
any honorable mentions if you want to do those first.
Yeah. So I want to do an honorable mention for the book first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only one that I have because it's scariest to me and also favorite for the book.
No, I know what you're talking about.
And in the book, things play out a little bit differently when adult Henry comes back around to attack the adult kids now.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Mike is in the library and it's like 2 a.m. It is late, late, late.
Yeah.
Or early, 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 depending on how you look at it. And so Mike is in the library and Henry shows up and Henry attacks him. But in the midst of everything that's going on with the scuffle and everything, back behind the checkout desk at the library, there is a sound, and then a like jack-in-the-box pops up.
Mm-hmm.
And the jack-in-the-box that pops up is Stan's head on a spring.
Yes.
And it's just like bouncing back and forth.
Right.
To me, that was some incredible imagery that King had written into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so sad that I didn't get that scene in the movies.
But I know.
I had to shout that out because that was so fucking good.
We did get We did get one Stanley head scene.
We
but
sure
like,
did.
I did appreciate that in the movie. How many times like Pennywise would use that as like a tool?
Yeah. Honorable mentions for chapter one, though.
Yep.
So, in the very beginning, when Beverly first meets Ben,
he has
a Walkman and he's listening to something, and
what
he's listening to is New Kids on the Block. And she kind of teases him about it a little bit, and then he's like, oh, I don't even like him, like that sort of thing. And then Beverly kind of lets him in the way of saying, oh, I like them, or I like this song, or something akin to like, you don't have to be ashamed of what you're listening
absolutely
to.
Yeah.
And so as she's walking away, he says another reference to his song, and he says, oh, that's another one of their songs. And she doesn't even hear him. She's
please
like,
don't go, girl.
Walking away. Yeah. And then later on, this is the honorable mention scene. They're in Ben's room, and he has like tidied everything up really quick as everybody's coming in. And he's standing there telling them about the things that he's learned about Derry. And he has all these pictures on his wall and everything, all these cutouts of different articles.
Right.
And Beverly's just kind of snooping around, and she slowly closes the door while like making eye contact with Ben. And there's a giant New Kids on the Block poster on the back of the door. And she just like makes eye contact with him and kind of like smirks at him and then opens the door again so that nobody else sees it.
That was such a good moment. I like how they play like a little rat, like a little like 15 second. Not even a couple seconds track of like New Kids on the Block, and Ben's just like, no, please, please, no. And she just like, yeah, slowly opens it back up.
Yeah. And I love that they did that in a way that the audience got to connect with these time periods, because in the book, the time periods are 1958 and like 1983 or something like that. And in the movies, the time periods are in the 80s and then in the thousands.
Yep.
So it's something that we can connect with better. And that scene is not in the book. So I thought that was just a good addition.
Absolutely.
Something that's a little bit of teasing,
it's
but
a
also
more,
a little bit of like.
Yeah. And it's a little bit more modern. And it's like, it's true to like Bev and Ben's characters too.
Yeah.
Like, and their banter.
Yeah. And because also Bev, in the book, I like her. In the movies, she's my favorite.
Oh my God. I know.
Yeah. And then my other honorable mention for chapter one was the scene where Beverly really enters into the group.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's kind of twofold. There's the scene where they have the rock fight, and like that's a big one. She joins in on that. Mm-hmm. Like that's them kind of bonding for the first time over a shared evil.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they're in the pharmacy or the drugstore, and they need to get all of these things to be able to patch up Ben.
Mm-hmm.
The kids or the guys separately are grabbing all of these things, and Beverly's coming in to go grab feminine hygiene products.
Mm-hmm.
And she's trying to hide it from that terrible girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up walking down the aisle that has all the guys on it. And they're like, we have like $2.
Yeah.
We can't get all these things.
Exactly.
And so she's like, oh, I got you. And so she walks up to the counter and she plays the ever living hell out of the pharmacist.
Out of Mr. Keene.
Yeah.
Out of fucking creepy ass Mr. Keene.
Yeah, that creepy ass old man. She plays him like a fiddle, distracts him the entire time, and then pushes a display of something on the ground.
It's cigarettes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A display of cigarettes on the ground. And he like bends down to pick them all up, and she's like, get out, get out. And so they all like leave and steal all the stuff. And that's just the moment where they're all, oh, it's the
gross.
Seven of us now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I think afterwards, you know, she comes by and Ben, Bill tries to give her all of the scraps of money that they had. Right.
Yeah.
And she pulls up her cigarettes and she's like, even Steven. And notices Ben, goes up, they have a little bit of a chat, and then later, as she's leaving, Bill's like, we're going to go hang out with the Corey tomorrow, like, if you want to come. And she says, I'll keep it in mind.
Yeah.
So I was like, at that point, it's like, oh my God. Yeah, no, she's in. She's in on it.
Yeah. My, I was having a really hard time because I have two scenes that are tied for scariest and favorite for chapter one.
Okay.
And the first one is, and this is, this would have been my scariest scene probably in the book. So my tie for scariest and favorite for chapter one is going to be in the very beginning of the movie. It's like one of the first things you see. Bill has made a paper boat for Georgie, and Georgie has to go down into the basement, and he's experiencing this moment that we all do as kids where it's like there is some unseen scary evil that exists in this space, and I just need to like run down, grab something, and get back up.
And if I run fast enough, it won't get me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if I run fast enough, evil doesn't exist. And so, and so he runs down and he gets this lacquer that they're going to put on the paper boat so that he's able to go outside and play.
Yep.
In the book, Bill is a little under the weather, doesn't want to go play. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, he doesn't really even say anything about being under the weather or anything. He just doesn't really want to go play. So he finishes this paper boat and sends Georgie outside with the paper boat. And it's raining a bunch and there's a nice current in the road. So Georgie puts the boat in the road and it starts floating down and he's running with it. The scenery, the way that this is filmed is gorgeous.
Oh my God. It is. It's
such beautiful tones in the greens, the street.
The fucking soundtrack.
The soundtrack is great. The way that the water's moving through the street is perfect. And then in a sea of all of these greens and aquas and everything, you get Georgie's stark yellow rain jacket.
Yes.
And it's just so beautiful. And he's following this boat. You can see that the boat is about to take a curve and it's about to go into the storm drain.
Yep.
And so he tries to run to catch up with it. And the boat ends up going down the drain. And Georgie goes to go like look for it. And when he goes down there, he has his first experience with Pennywise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go too much into the detail of the scene itself, but there is a shift where initially, Pennywise is very much talking to Georgie as like an overly friendly person, being like, oh, I'm just a clown. Oh, look, here's your boat.
Yeah.
Do you want your boat back? And he's very, I don't know, he's very expressive, kind of positive, a little bit animated and everything. And just being like, oh, well, I can give you your boat back.
Exactly. Just being very like childish and friendly.
Yeah.
With him.
Yeah. Being very animated and childish and friendly. And that was alphabetical. And he is like, well, I can give you your boat back. And he's having some laughs with them. And in the middle of one of those chucks that he's having with Georgie, he switches from laughing to just like deadpan staring at him.
Yeah. It's like the game is making him hungry.
Yeah.
Almost.
And that moment where he shifts from, oh, this is a clown, ha 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 ha, to like, this is evil, is it gave me chills. It was so good.
I even love like little like I can't remember the little boy's name that plays Georgie, but he was the youngest cast member on set.
Jackson Robert Scott.
Jackson, that's right. That's the name that came to my brain, but I didn't want to be wrong. Like he had said, because child actors are innocent and pure, that every scene he had with Bill was like so much fun. Like he didn't actually find him to be scary at all, which I thought was really cute. But he acted that really well. When that shift happens and he just kind of goes, I should get going now.
Yeah.
And, you know, he even at first like starts off with, I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. And Pennywise immediately catches that and goes, oh, well, then let me introduce myself. Because if I introduce myself to you, then we're not strangers anymore. In fact, we're even friends if you think about it. Yeah, he's very cunning.
He is.
In his games that he plays, especially with little kids. And that scene was really well done. Because I think in the book, Georgie doesn't go missing.
No.
One of the neighbors finds him pretty soon after, but he's dead. He like has this like look of horror on his face. And they take him home. And like he's able to get a funeral and get buried and have a grieving process. But in the movie, they do something a bit more clever, in my opinion, where they have Georgie very clearly died, but he goes missing. There's no closure for the family. And so where the parents essentially have to move on at some point, or have to at least tell themselves like, okay, he's dead. I'm not going to keep looking. His older brother, Bill, can't accept that same reality. And it's only a year after Georgie's death that the like beginning of chapter one starts.
Yeah. And it does shift the motive for Bill for the entirety of the story, because in the book, he is trying to vanquish the big bad to avenge Georgie, but also because there's a ton of kids that are going missing or dying and everything. And so he's just trying to get rid of the big bad that killed his brother. And in the movies, it starts more of a, we're trying to find Georgie.
Yeah, we're trying to find him.
Yeah.
And we're trying to find him because he must still be alive.
Yeah.
Right?
He can't accept him being
even
dead.
Being dead until the very end of the movie.
Yeah. So that's my tie for favorite and scariest for chapter one. Okay. What are your favorites for chapter one?
Okay, so for chapter one, I have three honorable mentions, and then I have my favorite.
I'm so excited.
So my first honorable mention is something very minor, but it's something that I found to be very fun in the movies, is that almost every single time that there's a TV on in the background, there's like some weird Pennywise programming.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Where it's
oh,
like,
my God, yeah.
I fucking loved that shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's just one of those weird little, like, details that's in the background that you're like, oh, my God, that's so cool. Just to kind of further lean into this idea that the parents and the adults in Derry are brainwashed. And it's essentially just that, like, pretty much, it's not every single time. Most of the time, it's like when Henry Bowers or Beverly's dad are like watching TV, and you can hear in the background the TV's on, and it's like a woman, and she's surrounded by a bunch of kids, and they're acting like they're in like a television children's program, right?
Yeah.
But she's giving like news, like, down, you should come down in the sewers, or we all float, and like, you should come and we're gonna have so much fun. Like, that's just kind of talking about all of that kind of stuff, right? And then it further leads into when Henry kills his dad and he hears on the TV, like, kill them all, right? Like, I just really liked that as just like a tiny little Easter egg that wasn't in the book, but worked really well in the movie.
Yeah, I think that was a really good way to portray it weaponizing Henry.
Yeah.
Because he's weaponized in the book, but it's in a way worse way.
Yeah, and it's a bit more subtle in the book too at times. I like the way that Henry is kind of slowly like indoctrinated by Pennywise in the films, because if we're being honest, like, Henry in the books, he didn't have a lot going for him in terms of already being a huge piece of shit because of his dad, right?
Yeah.
Like, he didn't really need Pennywise to be a bigger piece of shit. Like, I think Pennywise just almost knew that, like, that would be the perfect way to enact a lot of his torment of the Losers Club.
Yeah. And also, in the book, Henry isn't the shittiest one. Patrick's the shittiest one.
Yes.
But y'all will have to read to get that, because you don't get much of Patrick in the movies.
You don't get much of Patrick, and I don't really know how much we really want to discuss Patrick's.
No, I don't.
storyline in the book.
Yeah, I could never think about that refrigerator ever again,
and you would be a better person for it, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. A second honorable mention is when Bill, they're all by themselves. It's after Eddie has broken his arm and they're all separated.
Yeah.
And Bill goes down into the basement and it's flooded, and he sees Georgie down there. And initially he's talking to Georgie, and Georgie's like acting normal, but then he tells Bill, like, if you come down here, like, you'll float too. And then he just starts saying that over and over again, and it goes from him as, like, you know, regular alive Georgie to dead to decayed to like rotting Georgie to where he can like barely say "you'll float too" anymore. And then you see Pennywise kind of come up like a crocodile in the water, like just his eyeballs, and then you can see like his hand behind Georgie, like he's a puppet.
Yeah.
And after like the very last "you'll float too," Pennywise just like throws him into the water, like a puppet into the water, and then goes after, just does like this like and just like runs after Bill and chases him up the stairs.
Yeah.
And that was like one of my honorable mentions for favorite scenes.
I call those moments where he does his like running.
Yeah.
It's his zoomies.
Oh, yeah. I like that. It's his like Jin moment from Faz.
Yeah.
His like speed up moment. And then.
That's also a really good example of in these movies, Pennywise is camp as hell. He is just hilarious.
He thrives on what he calls salting the meat. Like he could just kill them in that moment. He could kill them anytime he wants to. But he really enjoys and almost, he describes it in the book, I feel like, as like tenderizing the meat. Like making it more flavorful by infusing it with fear.
Yeah.
And he's found this tactic to work like throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It wasn't just something that he just does for fun.
Yeah. It is interesting with the movies to have the big bad and a good fraction of the comic relief be from the same thing.
Yes.
Because, like, he's scary. He's also kind of funny.
He's also, He's kind of funny. And he's kind of charming, too.
Yeah.
Like, especially in those moments where, like, he heavily manipulates his victims.
Yeah.
And there's and it's mostly children,
That
he does it to. But it's done so well.
Oh, so good.
It's done so well. Finally, I think I'm just going to say my favorite scene. My other kind of honorable mention, it kind of ties into chapter two, so I might leave it and bring it back up later.
Okay.
So my absolute favorite scene in chapter one is after the Losers Club have gone to Niebolt Street because they've decided that's where it lives and they need to go investigate it. And they decide to draw straws and it's Richie, Eddie, and Bill go into the house. And they all get separated and Eddie falls through the second floor into the first floor and breaks his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes to, when Pennywise comes out of the refrigerator is my fucking favorite scene. I remember watching that in the theaters and just, I was like howling and cackling, but it was out of like pure entertainment.
Yeah. The way he's just kind of like shoved in there.
Yes.
Is hilarious.
He like comes out like the door opens, you see his hands, right? And they like the door opens and he comes out of the fridge and he has to like slowly like uncoil his body like as it's been like contorted in here. And when he finally he does like a full 180 and you can tell like his spine is turning around, right? And like the buttons line up and he like looks at Eddie and he just goes, "Time to float."
Yeah.
And he just does that like slow motion like moving towards him. I love every fucking second of that scene.
It was so
good. Oh my God. It's so good. And I have a fun trivia point about that scene too.
Yeah.
Do you want me to bring it up now?
Yeah, let's do it.
So that was the first time they purposely, the set designers and the directors, they kept Bill Skarsgård away from the children because they didn't want him to meet the children for the first time. They kind of knew what he looked like, but they didn't meet Bill and they didn't know what Pennywise looked like and they had no scenes with him. This was the very first time. And so while they were acting it, you know, Pennywise is like, he's choking Eddie out and he's like spitting and drooling. And he's screaming in his face and Jack, who's playing Eddie, is just like crying and gagging and, you know, like having this horrible moment. And so while they were filming it, Bill felt terrible. He was like, "Oh my God, I'm fucking traumatizing this child right now." Right. And when they yelled cut, he like looks at Jack and he's like, "Are you okay?" And Jack just like, "I love what you're doing with the character, man. You're awesome." I was like, "I love it. I love what you're doing with the character." And Bill was just like, "What the fuck?" Child actors are just cut from a different cloth, man.
They are brutal.
Yeah, and they just don't, they probably don't at that time, don't have that same like visceral emotional reaction that comes from acting a scene like that. They're able to just like, it's just like you pick a card out of a deck and you emote scared or you emote sad. And they're just like, "You want me to cry on camera? Got you."
Yeah.
Right? Like it has nothing to do with like bringing up past trauma or making my body feel a certain type of way. They're just like, "Whatever. I'm acting." Like we're playing right now. We're playing make believe and it's the best day ever.
I get paid to do this.
Exactly.
And
you know what I mean?
It's literally just me having fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my fucking favorite scene in chapter one.
That was such a good scene.
By a fucking landslide.
Absolutely. I think you're going to laugh really hard at my favorite scene for chapter two.
Right. Okay. So let's do that real quick before we do scary scenes. Let's get into our favorite scenes for chapter two.
So my favorite scene for chapter two, I have to back it up just a little bit. When they go into the house on Niebold Street, there is a scene that plays out where there are three doors that they have to choose from. And the three doors have written on them in what appears to be probably blood. One route is not scary at all. The next route is scary. And then the final one is like
very scary.
Very scary. And so when they're initially going through these doors, the first time they pick not very scary. And is it not very scary? Is that what it's
called?
Or is it just not scary?
I think
scary?
It's not scary at all.
Yeah, not scary at all.
Yeah.
And so they pick not scary at all. Wrong move. And then they end up going through scary. And that one is the one that leads them down the hallway.
Yeah.
But in chapter two, they run into these same set of doors.
And I think Richie's just like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah. So they're in the sewers at this point, and they run into these same set of doors. And they decide to go with, I think it's scary. They just decide to go with that one right off the bat. And they open it, and there's a Pomeranian. And it's just kind of sitting there like, just kind of looking up at them. And they're like, they look at one another like they can't really trust what they're seeing. And then they look back down at the Pomeranian and then like look back at one another. And there isn't really any dialogue or anything that happens in that moment. It's just them versus Pomeranian looking at one another. And then shortly after, the Pomeranian transforms into Pennywise.
Yeah, it's like a big monster dog and then turns into Pennywise after.
Yeah, but it just goes from this cute little tiny like orange Pomeranian into like monster. And I just thought that was so fucking funny.
So fucking good, god damn it. Is that your favorite?
Yeah.
Oh, did you have any honorable mentions you wanted?
No.
I love that so much.
I'll be totally honest in saying that I watched all of part two and I really didn't like it.
I know.
So I know. With that one, I didn't nerd out on it quite as much. I just picked the ones that I really liked.
Oh, absolutely. No, I commend you for that, honestly. Well, that's okay. I've got quite a few honorable mentions for favorite scene.
Sick.
So for chapter two, I'm going to bring this one up first. So I have like three honorable mentions. The first one that I wanted to bring up, this is just like a line in the movie that I really liked, because I don't think it's in, I don't want to say it's in the book, but it's when they're all by themselves and Adult Bill goes to the sewer where Georgie disappeared and he demands from Pennywise to know, out of all the children that he could have taken, why did he take Georgie? And Pennywise gives him the best line that he could have given him, which I just really, really liked. It really like hit me to my core when I heard it. You know, he's sitting there, he's demanding, why did you take him? He's crying. He's like, why out of all the children didn't like, could you've taken anybody else? And Pennywise just like, I don't even think he shows up. I think it's just his voice. He just says, because you weren't there.
Yeah.
I took him because it was the one day that you said, I don't want to play with my brother today. Yep. And you left him by himself.
He was like, just in case you weren't already feeling guilty.
Yeah.
Let me make you feel a little
worse. I'm going to dig that knife in just a little bit deeper. Yeah, and just like just really punch you right in the gut.
Let me twist that.
So I just, I love that. I love it so much. It's beautiful because it further solidifies the fact that like Bill has always felt guilty for Georgie's death and like that he had caused it by not being there for him. And just to further like solidify Pennywise, obviously like he didn't choose Georgie for any reason other than wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
Or right place, right time in terms of Pennywise. But he knew that that was the thing that he could say that would hurt him the most. And that's what I love. Like that's what makes it evil.
Yeah, this cosmic horror has an absurd amount of emotional intelligence when it comes to humans.
Yes, and he loves to throw it around too.
Oh,
like
yeah.
I really like, this is going a little bit back to chapter one, but at the very, very end when they kind of get it into a corner and he grabs Bill and he says, hey, I could kill all of you and I'm going to. That's my plan right now, right? Or I could just take him and you guys could all leave. And he says something really like sing-songy where he's like, you could all like live and lead long, happy lives. And he ends it with, until old age brings you back to the weeds.
Yeah.
And so he's just like, he's still like, he's so vindictive. And like, there's like acid in his voice when he talks about it, right? Where he like, he almost despises humanity.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. And he takes great pleasure in the things that he does. And it's almost not for just purely food purposes. He's not just doing it for nutrition. He's doing it for another reason, for whatever that reason is.
It really highlights. I've heard a couple of people who have read the book say that it is one of the most evil things to ever be put on the page.
Yeah.
And it is.
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. That's what I, that's kind of what I like about, about the Deadlights. It's supposed to be the antithesis of Maturin, the benevolent, like creator of worlds.
Yeah.
He is the opposite, the eater of worlds.
Yeah.
All he cares about is causing torment and consuming.
Probably one of the only other super well-developed and fully fleshed out characters that I've read that even compares as far as their malevolence goes is the judge from Blood Meridian that's written by Cormac McCarthy. They are probably neck and neck for the most evil thing I've ever read.
Sure.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Pennywise or the Deadlights is like got thousands of years on this judge, right? So like it's just hard to compare. So I need to bring that up. That was very important. The thing that I wanted to bring up earlier was just that the fact that like the endings for both the first and the second movie parallel each other. When the Losers Club goes to swim in the quarry afterwards, the first time they're all like washing off, you know, the trauma, and Bill starts crying over Georgie because they found his slicker when they were in the tunnel. And he starts crying and everybody rallies around him. And at the end of the second movie, they do the same thing. Eddie tragically sacrifices himself and dies. And Richie was like kind of, well, was in love with him.
Yeah.
And so when they're again in this mirrored shot of being in the quarry, it's Richie who starts crying and everybody consoles him. And it's not for Stan. It's for Eddie.
It's for Eddie. Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved that mirrored shot. And I really liked how heavily they leaned into the Richie and Eddie storyline in the movie, where I don't think it was as prevalent in the book.
They very lightly like talk about it in the way that they insinuate at one point that some people think that Eddie might be gay, and that's about it.
And that's it, right? And
yeah.
I really liked the fact that they went for it in in the movies.
Oh my God. Oh, at the end when Richie is carving the E into the
But I loved it because it really like it wraps it together.
It
wraps it all together. Let's see. Another honorable mention. I really like the fortune cookie scene.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the like all the little creatures and things coming out of the fortune cookies. I liked the mystery behind Stanley.
Yeah.
And them getting all of the like individual pieces and them being like, couldn't get it. Like, and then when Beverly gets Stanley's name and it just becoming very clear very quickly, that was such a good scene.
And that is a scene that is in the book.
Yeah.
It's just different.
I don't think they don't have fortunes. It's like it's all the creatures and things
Out. Yeah, there's like creatures, and I think one of them has like an eye in it.
Yeah.
Like,
one of them is like a deformed bird. Like it all has to do with like things that they experienced when they were children.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have two more. I really like the final mirror shot in chapter two.
Yeah.
When the rest of losers get up and Stan and Eddie aren't there, but it's just the rest of the adults, and they look in the window and they see their children selves in the reflection, and Stan and Eddie are there. I thought that was really poignant and really pretty, and I liked that they were like all on their bikes, like they were ready to go somewhere.
Yeah.
That's when we hear that really sweet line from Beverly where she says like, I didn't feel like I was a loser when I was with you guys.
Yeah.
Which is just fucking beautiful. It makes me want to cry, goddammit. And I had put in here the ritual of Chewed.
Mm-hmm.
I just like how they portrayed it in the movie.
Yeah.
Even if they had to make an entire native people up.
And even if the ritual is way different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I can still appreciate what the movie had to do.
Yeah.
But my favorite scene, this is because typically when I do my favorite scenes, I do the things that like make me laugh or make me have some sort of like outrageous emotion. So for me, it's when Richie, when they're in the sewers, they're in like the tunnel underneath the sewers and they're fighting Pennywise. And Richie gets up and he's going to say some like great one-liner.
Yeah.
And he I think he's going to say motherfucker. And he's just like, blah, 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 mother, boom.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so
it's like it goes, it's escalating, and then it's just like foghorn.
Oh,
yeah.
And he just gets lifted into the air, right?
It's so fucking funny.
That's my favorite scene.
Okay, in retrospect, I will throw out an honorable mention for chapter two. And it's just that we get to see the King of Horror himself.
Yes. Oh, of course. And I'm glad. I was going to bring that up in trivia, but I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah.
Just like the nice little store owner telling Bill Denbrough that his book, you know, endings suck.
Yeah. And I love that that's a play on Stephen King and how everybody says his endings always suck.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, yeah.
Oh, I like how he was razzing him, too. He's like, well, you're the big author. You can afford it.
Yeah. It was so good. And, you know, I don't want to come across as somebody who like defends King over and over again, but there is a reason he is labeled the King of Horror. He is the most prolific living author.
Yes.
Easily.
Easily.
And sure, he does some things that are a little out there. He writes some things that that rubs them the wrong way and everything. But I also will die on the hill that a lot of people have a lot of opinions about him that haven't read shit that he has written.
Yes. And absolutely. I will definitely agree with that. And I'll definitely say that, like, I remember trying to read, like, Needful Things as a teenager, and it just was too dense for me. I spent way too much time, like, reading about characters that I didn't care about, and then, like, now they're starting to die. So, like, I get it. I understand it. But he is definitely one of those writers that, like, if you stick with it, quite a bit of his works are absolutely phenomenal. There is a reason why he is so iconic at what he does. And I feel like I agree with you. A lot of people who probably do have something like poo-poo to say probably haven't truly taken the time to read the things that he's written.
Or read him as kids and didn't try to do it again as an adult.
That's what I'm saying. Because I would probably love Needful Things now.
It's
just,
when you're a kid. Okay, let me back up for a second. In my mind, Stephen King is, how do I put this? His skill set shines best when it comes to character development and world building.
Absolutely.
And then he just so happens to be really good at also throwing in some horror elements.
Right.
But to me, he is a world building and character development author. Mm-hmm. And when you're a kid, you don't care about that. So,
you care about like the more like intense things and
And now when you reapproach those as an adult, you're like, oh shit, no, this is a really good story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, like when you're talking about how this is a book where all 1,153 pages are necessary. When you're an adult, you realize that because you're like, no, it is necessary. It tells a cohesive, full, enriching story. If you took out 25-30% of this that sure didn't pertain to the storyline, it wouldn't feel as cohesive, as complete of a work.
Yeah.
As a result.
Yeah. I'm going to call back to The Shining for a second too. The thing that I really appreciate about some of those spaces that people would probably consider more like filler in the book is creating the character of Derry. Just like in The Shining, it creates the character of the Overlook.
Absolutely.
Like,
oh yeah.
That I love that he does that. And that's also not to say that every one of his works is a hit, because it's not.
No.
But when you're cranking out fucking a billion books in a lifetime, like, they're not going to be
winners. They're not all going to be winners, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not all going to be winners. That's true. Hey everybody, it's Karina. I'd like to tell you of a couple of announcements. We have got a Patreon now. You can subscribe at patreon.com/ It's Always Spooky. For $5 a month, we will be having some very special features, so stay tuned for those. Starting with every week, we'll be posting what episode we're planning on doing. So please make sure that you post your scariest and your favorite scenes so that we can feature them in the episode. If Patreon isn't your speed, you can also send us a tip on our Ko-fi account. That's Ko-fi.com/ It's Always Spooky. Please, please, please also email us your spooky stories and any recommendations to It's Always Spooky Podcast @gmail.com. Thank you so much. It's Always Spooky.